After working with the list a little while, Bean was just as glad that Dymac hadn't taken him up on his foolish offer to make up the roster on the spot. Because it wasn't just a matter of naming the 40 best soldiers among the launchies and the transfer lists. Wigan was way early for command, and that would make it harder for older kids to take it, getting put into a kid's army. So he struck off the list all who were older than Wigan. That left him with nearly 60 kids who were good enough to be in the army. Bean was ranking them in order of value when he realized that he was about to make another mistake. Quite a few of these kids were in the group of launchies and soldiers that practiced with Wigan during free time. Wigan would know these kids best, and naturally he'd look to them to be his toon leaders, the core of his army. The trouble was, while a couple of them would do fine as toon leaders, relying on that group would mean passing over several who weren't part of that group, including Bean. So he doesn't choose me to lead a toon. He isn't going to choose me anyway, right? I'm too little. He won't look at me and see a leader. Is this just about me, then? Am I corrupting this process just to get myself a chance to show what I can do? And if I am, what's wrong with that? I know what I can do, and no one else really gets it. The teachers think I'm a scholar. They know I'm smart. They trust my judgment, but they aren't making this army for me. They're making it for him. I still have to prove to them what I can do. And if I really am one of the best, it would be to the benefit of the program to have it revealed as quickly as possible. And then he thought, is this how idiots rationalize their stupidity to themselves? Ho, Bean, said Nikolai. Ho, said Bean. He passed a hand across his desk, blanking the display. Tell me. Nothing to tell. You looked grim. Just doing an assignment. Nikolai laughed. You never look that serious doing classwork. You just read for a while and then you type for a while. Like it was nothing. This is something. An extra assignment. A hard one, eh? Not very. Sorry to break in. Just thought maybe something was wrong. Maybe a letter from home. They both laughed at that. Letters weren't that common here. Every few months at the most. And the letters were pretty empty when they came. Some never got mail at all. Bean was one of them, and Nikolai knew why. It wasn't a secret. He was just the only one who noticed and the only one who asked about it. No family at all? He had said. Some kids' families, maybe I'm the lucky one, Bean answered him, and Nikolai agreed. But not mine. I wish you had parents like mine. And then he went on about how he was an only child, but his parents really worked hard to get him. They did it with surgery. Fertilized 5 or 6 eggs, then twinned the healthiest ones a few more times, and finally they picked me. I grew up like I was going to be king or the Dalai Lama or something. And then one day the IF says we need him. Hardest thing my parents ever did, saying yes. But I said, what if I'm the next Maserakim? And they let me go. That was months ago, but it was still between them, that conversation. Kids didn't talk much about home. Nikolai didn't discuss his family with anybody else either. Just with Bean. And in return, Bean told him a little about life on the street. Not a lot of details, because it would sound like he was asking for pity or trying to look cool. But he mentioned how they were organized into a family. Talked about how it was Poke's crew, and then it became Ashiel's family, and how they got into a charity kitchen. Then Bean waited to see how much of this story started circulating. None of it did. Nikolai never said a word about it to anyone else. That was when Bean was sure that Nikolai was worth having as a friend. He could keep things to himself without even having to be asked to do it. And now here Bean was, making up the roster for this great army, and here sat Nikolai, asking him what he was doing. Dymac had said to tell no one. But Nikolai could keep a secret. What harm could it do? Then Bean recovered his senses. Knowing about this wouldn't help Nikolai in any way. Either he'd be in Dragon Army or he wouldn't. If he wasn't, he'd know Bean hadn't put him there. If he was, it would be worse, because he'd wonder if Bean had included him in the roster out of friendship instead of excellence. Besides, Nikolai shouldn't be in Dragon Army. Bean liked him and trusted him, but Nikolai was not among the best of the launchies. He was smart, he was quick, he was good, but he was nothing special. Except to me, thought Bean. It was a letter from your parents, said Bean. They've stopped writing to you. They like me better.
Yeah, and the Vatican is moving to Mecca,
and I'm going to be made Polemarch.
No jeito, though, said Nikolai.
You too tall, bicho.
Nikolai picked up his desk.
I can't help you with your classwork tonight, Bean, so please don't beg me.
He lay back on his bed, started into the fantasy game. Bean lay back too. He woke up his display and began wrestling with the names again. If he eliminated every one of the kids who'd been practicing with Wigan, how many of the good ones would it leave? 15 veterans from the transfer lists, 22 launchies, including Bean. Why hadn't these launchies taken part in Wigan's free time practices? The veterans, they were already in trouble with their commanders, they weren't about to antagonize them anymore, so it made sense for them not to have taken part. But these launchies, weren't they ambitious? Or were they bookish, trying to do it all through classwork instead of catching on that the battle room was everything? Bean couldn't fault them for that. It had taken him a while to catch on, too. Were they so confident of their own abilities they didn't think they needed the extra prep? Or so arrogant they didn't want anybody to think they owed their success to Ender Wigan? Or so shy they... No. He couldn't possibly guess their motives. They were all too complex anyway. They were smart, with good evaluations. Good by Bean's standards, not necessarily by the teachers. That was all he needed to know. If he gave Wigan an army without a single kid he'd worked with in practices, then all the army would start out equal in his eyes. Which meant Bean would have the same chance as any other kid to earn Wigan's eye and maybe get command of a tune. If they couldn't compete with Bean for that position, then too damn bad for them. But that left him with 37 names on the roster. 3 more slots to fill. He went back and forth on a couple. Finally decided to include Crazy Tom, a veteran who held the unenviable record of being the most transferred soldier in the history of the game who wasn't actually iced and sent home. So far. The thing was, Crazy Tom really was good. Sharp mind. But he couldn't stand it when somebody above him was stupid and unfair. And when he got pissed, he really went off. Ranting, throwing things, tearing bedding off every bed in his barracks once, another time writing a message about what an idiot his commander was and mailing it to every other student in the school. A few actually got it before the teachers intercepted it, and they said it was the hottest thing they ever read. Crazy Tom could be disruptive. But maybe he was just waiting for the right commander. He was in. And a girl, Wu, which of course had become Wu and even Woo-hoo. Brilliant at her studies, absolutely a killer in the arcade games, but she refused to be a toon leader and as soon as her commanders asked her, she put in for a transfer and refused to fight until they gave it to her. Weird. Bean had no idea why she did that. The teachers were baffled too. Nothing in her tests to show why. What the hell? Thought Bean. She's in. Last slot. He typed in Nikolai's name. Am I doing him a favor? He's not bad. He's just a little slower than these kids, just a little gentler. It'll be hard for him. And if he's left out of it, he won't mind. He'll just do his best with whatever army he gets sent to eventually. And yet, Dragon Army is going to be a legend. Not just here in battle school, either. These kids are going to go on to be leaders in the IF. Or somewhere, anyway. And they'll tell stories about when they were in Dragon Army with the great Ender Wigan. And if I include Nikolai, then even if he isn't the best of the soldiers, even if he's in fact the slowest, he'll still be in. He'll still be able to tell those stories someday.
And he's not bad. He won't embarrass himself. He won't bring down the army. He'll do okay. So why not? And I want him with me. He's the only one I've ever talked to about personal things. The only one who knows the name of Polk. I want him. And there's a slot on the roster. Bean went down the list one more time. Then he alphabetized it and mailed it to Dymack. The next morning, Bean, Nikolai, and three other kids in their launch group had their assignment to Dragon Army. Months before, they should have been promoted to soldiers. The unchosen kids were envious, hurt, furious by turn, especially when they realized Bean was one of the chosen. Do they make uniform flash suits that size? It was a good question. And the answer was no, they didn't. The colors of Dragon Army were gray, orange, gray. Because soldiers were usually a lot older than Bean when they came in, they had to cut a flash suit down for Bean, and they didn't do it all that well. Flash suits weren't manufactured in space, and nobody had the tools to do a first-rate job of alteration. When they finally got it to fit him, Bean wore his flash suit to the Dragon Army barracks. Because it had taken him so long to be fitted, he was the last to arrive. Wigan arrived at the door just as Bean was entering. "Go ahead," said Wigan. It was the first time Wigan had ever spoken to him. For all Bean knew, the first time Wigan had even noticed him. So thoroughly had Bean concealed his fascination with Wigan that he had made himself effectively invisible. Wigan followed him into the room. Bean started down the corridor between the bunks, heading for the back of the room where the younger soldiers always had to sleep. He glanced at the other kids, who were all looking at him as he passed with a mixture of horror and amusement. They were in an army so lame that this little tiny kid was part of it? Behind him, Wigan was starting his first speech. Voice confident, loud enough, but not shouting, not nervous. "I'm Ender Wigan. I'm your commander. Bunking will be arranged by seniority." Some of the launchies groaned. "Veterans to the back of the room, newest soldiers to the front." The groaning stopped. That was the opposite of the way things were usually arranged. Wigan was already shaking things up. Whenever he came into the barracks, the kids closest to him would be the new ones. Instead of getting lost in the shuffle, they'd always have his attention. Bean turned around and headed back to the front of the room. He was still the youngest kid in battle school, but five of the soldiers were from more recently arrived launch groups, so they got the positions nearest the door. Bean got an upper bunk directly across from Nikolai, who had the same seniority, being from the same launch group. Bean clambered up onto his bed, hampered by his flash suit, and put his palm beside the locker. Nothing happened. "Those of you who are in an army for the first time," said Wigan, "just pull the locker open by hand. No locks. Nothing private here." Laboriously, Bean pulled off his flash suit to stow it in his locker. Wigan walked along between the bunks, making sure that seniority was respected. Then he jogged to the front of the room. "All right, everybody. Put on your flash suits and come to practice." Bean looked at him in complete exasperation. Wigan had been looking right at him when he started taking off his flash suit. Why didn't he suggest that Bean not take the damn thing off? "We're on the morning schedule," Wigan continued. "Straight to practice after breakfast. Officially, you have a free hour between breakfast and practice. We'll see what happens after I find out how good you are." Truth was, Bean felt like an idiot. Of course Wigan would head for practice immediately. He shouldn't have needed a warning not to take the suit off. He should have known. He tossed his suit pieces onto the floor and slid down the frame of the bunk. A lot of the other kids were talking, flipping clothes at each other, playing with their weapons. Bean tried to put on the cut-down suit, but couldn't figure out some of the jury-rigged fastenings. He had to take off several pieces and examine them to see how they fit, and finally gave up, took it all off, and started assembling it on the floor. Wigan, unconcerned, glanced at his watch. Apparently, 3 minutes was his deadline. "All right, everybody out, now! On your way!"
"But I'm naked,"
said one boy. Anwar, from Ecuador, child of Egyptian immigrants. His dossier ran through Bean's mind. Dress faster next time, said Wigan. Bean was naked, too. Furthermore, Wigan was standing right there, watching him struggle with his suit. He could have helped. He could have waited. What am I getting myself in for? 3 minutes from first call to running out the door. That's the rule this week, said Wigan. Next week the rule is 2 minutes. Move. Out in the corridor, kids who were in the midst of free time or were heading for class stopped to watch the parade of the unfamiliar uniforms of Dragon Army, and to mock the ones that were even more unusual. One thing for sure, Bean was going to have to practice getting dressed in his cut-down suit if he was going to avoid running naked through the corridors. And if Wigan didn't make any exceptions for him the first day, when he only just got his non-regulation flash suit, Bean certainly was not going to ask for special favors. I chose to put myself in this army, Bean reminded himself as he jogged along, trying to keep pieces of his flash suit from spilling out of his arms.
Part 4. Soldier. Chapter 13. Dragon Army.
I need access to Bean's genetic information, said Sister Carlotta.
That's not for you, said Graf.
And here I thought my clearance level would open any door.
We invented a special new category of security called Not for Sister Carlotta. We don't want you sharing Bean's genetic information with anyone else. And you were already planning on putting it in other hands, weren't you?
Only to perform a test. So, you'll have to perform it for me. I want a comparison between Bean's DNA and Valescu's.
I thought you told me Valescu was the source of the cloned DNA.
I've been thinking about it since I told you that, Colonel Graf. And you know what? Bean doesn't look anything like Valescu. I couldn't see how he could possibly grow up to be like him, either.
Maybe the difference in growth patterns makes him look different, too.
Maybe. But it's also possible Valescu is lying. He's a vain man.
Lying about everything?
Lying about anything. About paternity, quite possibly. And if he's lying about that...
Then maybe Bean's prognosis isn't so bleak. Don't you think we've already checked with our genetics people? Valescu wasn't lying about that, anyway. Anton's key will probably behave just the way he described.
Please... Run the test and tell me the results.
Because you don't want Bean to be Valescu's son.
I don't want Bean to be Valescu's twin. And neither, I think, do you.
Good point. Though I must tell you, the boy does have a vain streak.
When you're as gifted as Bean, accurate self-assessment looks like vanity to other people.
Yeah, but he doesn't have to rub it in, does he?
Uh-oh. Has someone's ego been hurt?
Not mine. Yet. But one of his teachers is feeling a little bruised.
I notice you aren't telling me I faked his scores anymore.
Yes, Sister Carlotta, you were right all along. He deserves to be here, and so does... Well, let's just say you hit the jackpot after all those years of searching.
It's humanity's jackpot.
I said he was worth bringing up here. Not that he was the one who'll lead us to victory. The wheel's still spinning on that one. And my money's on another number.
Going up the ladderways while holding a flash suit wasn't practical, so Wigan made the ones who were dressed run up and down the corridor, working up a sweat while Bean and the other naked or partially dressed kids got their suits on. Nikolai helped Bean get his suit fastened. It humiliated Bean to need help, but it would have been worse to be the last one finished.
the pesky little teeny brat who slows everyone down. With Nikolai's help, he was not the last one done.
Thanks. No ojike.
Moments later, they were streaming up the ladders to the battle room level. Wigan took them all the way to the upper door, the one that opened out into the middle of the battle room wall, the one used for entering when it was an actual battle. There were handholds on the sides, the ceiling, and the floor, so students could swing out and hurl themselves into the null G environment. The story was that gravity was lower in the battle room because it was closer to the center of the station, but Bean had already realized that was bogus. There would still be some centrifugal force at the doors and a pronounced Coriolis effect. Instead, the battle rooms were completely null. To Bean, that meant that the IF had a device that would either block gravitation or, more likely, produce false gravity that was perfectly balanced to counter Coriolis and centrifugal forces in the battle room, starting exactly at the door. It was a stunning technology, and it was never discussed inside the IF, at least not in the literature available to students in battle school, and completely unknown outside. Wigan assembled them in four files along the corridor and ordered them to jump up and use the ceiling handholds to fling their bodies into the room. Assemble on the far wall, as if you were going for the enemy's gate. To the veterans, that meant something. To the launchies, who had never been in a battle and had never, for that matter, entered through the upper door, it meant nothing at all. Run up and go four at a time when I open the gate, one group per second. Wigan walked to the back of the group, and using his hook, a controller strapped to the inside of his wrist and curved to conform to his left hand, he made the door, which had seemed quite solid, disappear.
Go!
The first four kids started running for the gate.
Go!
The next group began to run before the first had even reached it. There would be no hesitation or somebody would crash into you from behind.
Go!
The first group grabbed and swung with varying degrees of clumsiness and heading out in various directions.
Go!
Later groups learned, or tried to, from the awkwardness of the earlier ones.
Go!
Bean was at the end of the line, in the last group. Wigan laid a hand on his shoulder. You can use a side handhold if you want. Right, thought Bean. Now you decide to baby me. Not because my Meshuggah flash suit didn't fit together right, but just because I'm short.
Go suck on it, said Bean.
Go! Bean kept pace with the other three, though it meant pumping his legs half again as fast, and when he got near the gate he took a flying leap, tapped the ceiling handhold with his fingers as he passed, and sailed out into the room with no control at all, spinning in three nauseating directions at once. But he didn't expect himself to do any better, and instead of fighting the spin, he calmed himself and did his anti-nausea routine, relaxing himself until he neared a wall and had to prepare for impact. He didn't land near one of the recessed handholds and wasn't facing the right way to grab anything, even if he had. So he rebounded, but this time was a little more stable as he flew, and he ended up on the ceiling very near the back wall. It took him less time than some to make his way down to where the others were assembling, lined up along the floor under the middle gate on the back wall. The enemy gate. Wigan sailed calmly through the air. Because he had a hook, during practice he could maneuver in midair in ways that soldiers couldn't. During battle, though, the hook would be useless, so commanders had to make sure they didn't become dependent on the hook's added control. Bean noted approvingly that Wigan seemed not to use the hook at all. He sailed in sideways, snagged a handhold on the floor about 10 paces out from the back wall, and hung in the air. Upside down. Fixing his gaze on one of them, Wigan demanded, "Why are you upside down, soldier?" Immediately, some of the other soldiers started to turn themselves upside down like Wigan.
"Attention!"
Wigan barked. All movement stopped. "I said, why are you upside down?" Bean was surprised that the soldier didn't answer. Had he forgotten what the teacher did in the shuttle on the way here? The deliberate disorientation? Or was that something that only Dymac did? "I said, why does every one of you have his feet in the air and his head toward the ground?" Wigan didn't look at Bean in particular, and this was one question Bean didn't want to answer. There was no assurance of which particular correct answer Wigan was looking for, so why open his mouth just to get shut down? It was a kid named Shame, short for Seamus, who finally spoke up.
"Sir, this is the direction we were in coming out of the door."
Good job, thought Bean. Better than some lame argument that there was no up or down in Null G.
Well, what difference is that supposed to make? What difference does it make what the gravity was back in the corridor? Are we going to fight in the corridor? Is there any gravity here?
No, sir, they all murmured. From now on, you forget about gravity before you go through that door. The old gravity is gone, erased. Understand me? Whatever your gravity is, when you get to the door, remember, the enemy's gate is down. Your feet are toward the enemy gate. Up is toward your own gate. North is that way. He pointed toward what had been the ceiling. South is that way. East is that way. West is... What way? They pointed.
That's what I expected, said Wigan. The only process you've mastered is the process of elimination, and the only reason you've mastered that is because you can do it in the toilet.
Bean watched, amused. So Wigan subscribed to the "you're so stupid you need me to wipe your butts" school of basic training. Well, maybe that was necessary. One of the rituals of training. Boring till it was over, but commander's choice.
Wigan glanced at Bean, but his eyes kept moving. What was the circus I saw out here? Did you call that forming up? Did you call that flying? Now everybody launch and form up on the ceiling. Right now. Move!
Bean knew what the trap was and launched for the wall they had just entered through before Wigan had even finished talking. Most of the others also got what the test was, but a fair number of them launched the wrong way. Toward the direction Wigan had called north instead of the direction he had identified as up. This time Bean happened to arrive near a handhold, and he caught it with surprising ease. He had done it before in his launch group's battle room practices, but he was small enough that, unlike the others, it was quite possible for him to land in a place that had no handhold within reach. Short arms were a definite drawback in the battle room. On short bounds, he could aim at a handhold and get there with some accuracy. On a cross-room jump, there was little hope of that. So it felt good that this time, at least, he didn't look like an oaf. In fact, having launched first, he arrived first. Bean turned around and watched as the ones who had blown it made the long, embarrassing second leap to join the rest of the army. He was a little surprised at who some of the bozos were. Inattention can make clowns of us all, he thought. Wigan was watching him again. And this time it was no passing glance.
You, Wigan pointed at him. Which way is down?
Didn't we just cover this?
Toward the enemy door.
Name, kid?
Come on. Wigan really didn't know who the short kid with the highest scores in the whole damn school was.
Well, if we're playing mean sergeant and hapless recruit, I better follow the script.
This soldier's name is Bean, sir.
Get that for size or for brains? Some of the other soldiers laughed, but not many of them. They knew Bean's reputation. To them, it was no longer funny that he was so small. It was just embarrassing that a kid that small could make perfect scores on tests that had questions they didn't even understand.
Well, Bean, you're right on to things.
Wigan now included the whole group as he launched into a lecture on how coming through the door feet first made you a much smaller target for the enemy to shoot at. Harder for him to hit you and freeze you. Now what happens when you're frozen?
Can't move, somebody said.
That's what frozen means, said Wigan. But what happens to you? Wigan wasn't phrasing his question very clearly, in Bean's opinion, and there was no use in prolonging the agony while the others figured it out. So Bean spoke up.
You keep going in the direction you started in, at the speed you were going when you were flashed.
That's true, said Wigan.
You five, there on the end, move!
He pointed at five soldiers, who spent long enough looking at each other to make sure which five he meant that Wigan had time to flash them all, freezing them in place.
During practice, it took a few minutes for a freeze to wear off, unless the commander used his hook to unfreeze them earlier. The next five, move. Seven kids moved at once. No time to count. Wigan flashed them as quickly as he flashed the others, but because they had already launched, they kept moving at a good clip toward the walls they had headed for. The first five were hovering in the air near where they had been frozen.
Look at these so-called soldiers. Their commander ordered them to move, and now look at them. Not only are they're frozen right here, where they can get in the way. While the others, because they moved when they were ordered, are frozen down there, plugging up the enemy's lanes, blocking the enemy's vision. I imagine that about five of you have understood the point of this.
We all understand it, Wigan. It's not like they bring stupid people up here to battle school. It's not like I didn't pick you the best available army. And no doubt Bean is one of them. Right, Bean? Bean could hardly believe that Wigan was singling him out again.
Just because I'm little, he's using me to embarrass the others. The little guy knows the answers, so why don't you big boys?
But then Wigan doesn't realize yet.
He thinks he has an army of incompetent launchees and rejects. He hasn't had a chance to see that he actually has a select group. So he thinks of me as the most ludicrous of a sad lot.
He's found out I'm not an idiot, but he still assumes the others are.
Wigan was still looking at him.
Oh, yeah. He had asked a question.
Right, sir, said Bean.
Then what is the point?
Spit back to him exactly what he just said to us. When you were ordered to move, move fast, so if you get iced, you'll bounce around instead of getting in the way of your own army's operations.
Excellent. At least I have one soldier who can figure things out. Bean was disgusted.
This was the commander who was supposed to turn Dragon into a legendary army? Wigan was supposed to be the alpha and omega of the battle school, and he's playing the game of singling me out to be the goat. Wigan didn't even find out our scores, didn't discuss his soldiers with the teachers. If he did, he'd already know that I'm the smartest kid in the school. The others all know it. That's why they're looking at each other in embarrassment. Wigan is revealing his own ignorance.
Bean saw how Wigan seemed to be registering the distaste of his own soldiers.
It was just an eye blink, but maybe Wigan finally got it that his make fun of the shrimp ploy was backfiring. Because he finally got on with the business of training. He taught them how to kneel in midair, even flashing their own legs to lock them in place, and then fire between their knees as they moved downward toward the enemy, so that their legs became a shield, absorbing fire and allowing them to shoot for longer periods of time out in the open. A good tactic. And Bean finally began to get some idea of why Wigan might not be a disastrous commander after all. He could sense the others giving respect to their new commander at last. When they'd got the point, Wigan thawed himself and all the soldiers he had frozen in the demonstration.
Now, he said, which way is the enemy's gate?
Down,
they all answered.
And what is our attack position?
Oh, right, thought Bean. Like we can all give an explanation in unison. The only way to answer was to demonstrate. So Bean flipped himself away from the wall, heading for the other side, firing between his knees as he went. He didn't do it perfectly. There was a little rotation as he went, but all in all he did okay for his first actual attempt at the maneuver. Above him he heard Wigan shout at the others, "Is Bean the only one who knows how?" By the time Bean had caught himself on the far wall, the whole rest of the army was coming after him, shouting as if they were on the attack. Only Wigan remained at the ceiling. Bean noticed with amusement that Wigan was standing there oriented the same way he had been in the corridor. His head north, the old up. He might have the theory down pat, but in practice it's hard to shake off the old gravity-based thinking. Bean had made it a point to orient himself sideways, his head to the west. And the soldiers near him did the same, taking their orientation from him. If Wigan noticed, he gave no sign. Now come back at me, all of you. Attack me. Immediately his flash suit lighted up with 40 weapons firing at him as his entire army converged on him, firing all the way. "Ouch," said Wigan when they arrived. "You got me." Most of them laughed. "Now what are your legs good for in combat?" "Nothing," said some boys. "Bean doesn't think so," said Wigan. "So he isn't going to let up on me even now." "Well, what does he want to hear?" Somebody else muttered shields, but Wigan didn't key in on that, so he must have something else in mind. "They're the best way to push off walls," Bean guessed. "Right," said Wigan. "Come on. Pushing off is movement, not combat," said Crazy Tom. A few others murmured their agreement. "Oh, good. Now it starts," thought Bean. Crazy Tom picks a meaningless quarrel with his commander, who gets pissed off at him and... But Wigan didn't take umbrage at Crazy Tom's correction. He just corrected him back mildly. "There is no combat without movement. Now, with your legs frozen like this, can you push off walls?" Bean had no idea. Neither did anyone else. "Bean?" asked Wigan. "Of course." "I've never tried it," said Bean. "But maybe if you faced the wall and doubled over at the waist..." "Right, but wrong. Watch me. My back's to the wall, legs are frozen. Since I'm kneeling, my feet are against the wall. Usually when you push off, you have to push downward, so you string out your body behind you like a string bean, right?" The group laughed. For the first time, Bean realized that maybe Wigan wasn't being stupid to get the whole group laughing at the little guy. Maybe Wigan knew perfectly well that Bean was the smartest kid and had singled him out like this because he could tap into all the resentment the others felt for him. This whole session was guaranteeing that the other kids would all think it was okay to laugh at Bean, to despise him even though he was smart. "Great system, Wigan. Destroy the effectiveness of your best soldier. Make sure he gets no respect." However, it was more important to learn what Wigan was teaching than to feel sullen about the way he was teaching it. So Bean watched intently as Wigan demonstrated a frozen leg takeoff from the wall. He noticed that Wigan gave himself a deliberate spin. It would make it harder for him to shoot as he flew, but it would also make it very hard for a distant enemy to focus enough light on any part of him for long enough to get a kill. "I may be pissed off, but that doesn't mean I can't learn." It was a long and grueling practice, drilling over and over again on new skills. Bean saw that Wigan wasn't willing to let them learn each technique separately. They had to do them all at once, integrating them into smooth, continuous movements. Like dancing, Bean thought. You don't learn to shoot and then learn to launch and then learn to do a controlled spin. You learn to launch, shoot, spin. At the end, all of them dripping with sweat, exhausted, and flushed with the excitement of having learned stuff that they'd never heard of other soldiers doing, Wigan assembled them at the lower door and announced that they'd have another practice during free time. "And don't tell me that free time is supposed to be free. I know that, and you're perfectly free to do what you want. I'm inviting you to come to an extra, voluntary practice." They laughed. This group consisted entirely of kids who had not chosen to do extra battle room practice with Wigan before, and he was making sure they understood that he expected them to change their priorities now. But they didn't mind. After this morning, they knew that when Wigan ran a practice, every second was effective. They couldn't afford to miss a practice or they'd fall significantly behind. Wigan would get their free time. Even Crazy Tom wasn't arguing about it. But Bean knew that he had to change his relationship with Wigan right now, or there was no chance that he would get a chance for leadership. What Wigan had done to him in today's practice, feeding on the resentment of the other kids for this little pipsqueak, would make it even less plausible for Bean to be made a leader within the army. If the other kids despised him, who would follow him? So Bean waited for Wigan in the corridor after the others had gone on ahead. "Ho, Bean," said Wigan. "Ho, Ender," said Bean. Did Wigan catch the sarcasm in the way Bean said his name? Was that why he paused a moment before answering? "Sir," said Wigan softly. Oh, cut out the Merida. I've seen those vids. We all laugh at those vids.
I know what you're doing, Ender, sir, and I'm warning you.
Warning me?
I can be the best man you've got, but don't play games with me.
Or what?
Or I'll be the worst man you've got. One or the other.
Not that Bean expected Wigan to understand what he meant by that. How Bean could only be effective if he had Wigan's trust and respect. How otherwise he'd just be the little kid, useful for nothing.
Wigan would probably take it to mean that Bean meant to cause trouble if Wigan didn't use him.
And maybe he did mean that, a little.
And what do you want? Asked Wigan.
Love and kisses?
Say it flat out. Put it in his mind so plainly he can't pretend not to understand.
I want a tune.
Wigan walked close to Bean, looked down at him. To Bean, though, it was a good sign that Wigan hadn't just laughed.
Why should you get a tune?
Because I'd know what to do with it.
Knowing what to do with a tune is easy. It's getting them to do it that's hard.
Why should any soldier want to follow a little pinprick like you?
Wigan had got straight to the crux of the problem. But Bean didn't like the malicious way he said it.
They used to call you that, I hear. I hear Bonzo Madrid still does.
Wigan wasn't taking the bait. I asked you a question, soldier.
I'll earn their respect, sir, if you don't stop me.
To his surprise, Wigan grinned.
I'm helping you.
Like hell.
Nobody would notice you except to feel sorry for the little kid. But I made sure they all noticed you today.
You should have done your research, Wigan. You're the only one who didn't know already who I was.
They'll be watching every move you make, said Wigan. All you have to do to earn their respect now is be perfect.
So I don't even get a chance to learn before I'm being judged.
That's not how you bring along talent.
Poor kid. Nobody's treating him fair.
Wigan's deliberate obtuseness infuriated Bean. You're smarter than this, Wigan. Seeing Bean's rage, Wigan brought a hand forward and pushed him until his back rested firmly against the wall.
I'll tell you how to get a tune.
Prove to me you know what you're doing as a soldier. Prove to me you know how to use other soldiers. And then prove to me that somebody's willing to follow you into battle.
Then you'll get your tune.
But not bloody well until.
Bean ignored the hand pressing against him. It would take a lot more than that to intimidate him physically.
That's fair, he said. If you actually work that way, I'll be a tune leader in a month.
Now it was Wigan's turn to be angry. He reached down, grabbed Bean by the front of his flash suit, and slid him up the wall so they stood there eye to eye.
When I say I work a certain way, Bean, then that's the way I work.
Bean just grinned at him. In this low gravity, so high in the station, picking up little kids wasn't any big test of strength. And Wigan was no bully. There was no serious threat here.
Wigan let go of him. Bean slid down the wall and landed gently on his feet, rebounded slightly, settled again.
Wigan walked to the pole and slid down.
Bean had won this encounter by getting under Wigan's skin. Besides, Wigan knew he hadn't handled this situation very well. He wouldn't forget. In fact, it was Wigan who had lost a little respect, and he knew it, and he'd be trying to earn it back.
Unlike you, Wigan, I do give the other guy a chance to learn what he's doing before I insist on perfection.
You screwed up with me today, but I'll give you a chance to do better tomorrow and the next day.
But when Bean got to the pole and reached out to take hold, he realized his hands were trembling and his grip was too weak. He had to pause a moment, leaning on the pole, till he had calmed enough. That face-to-face encounter with Wigan. He hadn't won that. It might even have been a stupid thing to do. Wigan had hurt him with those snide comments, that ridicule.
Bean had been studying Wigan as the subject of his private theology, and today he had found out that all this time Wigan didn't even know Bean existed.
Everybody compared Bean to Wigan, but apparently Wigan hadn't heard or didn't care. He had treated Bean like nothing. And after having worked so hard this past year to earn respect, he didn't find it easy to be nothing again. It brought back feelings he thought he left behind in Rotterdam. The sick fear of imminent death. Even though he knew that no one here would raise a hand against him, he still remembered being on the edge of dying when he first went up to Poke and put his life in her hands. Is that what I've done once again? By putting myself on this roster, I gave my future into this boy's hands. I counted on him seeing in me what I see. But of course he couldn't. I have to give him time. If there was time. For the teachers were moving quickly now, and Bean might not have a year in this army to prove himself to Wigan.
Chapter 14. Brothers.
You have results for me?
Interesting ones. Volescu was lying. Somewhat.
I hope you're going to be more precise than that.
Bean's genetic alteration was not based on a clone of Volescu. But they are related. Volescu is definitely not Bean's father, but he is almost certainly Volescu's half-uncle or a double cousin. I hope Volescu has a half-brother or double first cousin, because such a man is the only possible father of the fertilized egg that Volescu altered.
You have a list of Volescu's relatives, I assume.
We didn't need any family at the trial, and Volescu's mother was not married. He uses her name.
So Volescu's father had another child somewhere, only you don't even know his name. I thought you knew everything.
We know everything that we knew was worth knowing. That's a crucial distinction. We simply haven't looked for Volescu's father. He's not guilty of anything important. We can't investigate everybody.
Another matter. Since you know everything that you know is worth knowing, perhaps you can tell me why a certain crippled boy has been removed from the school where I placed him.
Oh, him. When you suddenly stopped touting him, we got suspicious, so we checked him out, tested him. He's no Bean, but he definitely belongs here.
And it never crossed your mind that I had good reason for keeping him out of battle school?
We assumed that you thought that we might choose Ashiel over Bean, who was, after all, far too young, so you offered only your favorite.
You assumed. I've been dealing with you as if you were intelligent, and you've been dealing with me as if I were an idiot. Now I see it should have been the exact reverse.
I didn't know Christians got so angry.
Is Ashiel already in battle school?
He's still recovering from his fourth surgery. We have to fix the leg on Earth.
Let me give you a word of advice. Do not put him in battle school while Bean is still there.
Bean is only 6. He's still too young to enter battle school, let alone graduate.
If you put Ashiel in, take Bean out. Period.
Why?
If you're too stupid to believe me after all my other judgments turned out to be correct, why should I give you the ammunition to let you second-guess me? Let me just say that putting them in school together is a probable death sentence for one of them.
Which one?
That rather depends on which one sees the other first.
Ashiel says he owes everything to Bean. He loves Bean.
Then by all means, believe him and not me. But don't send the body of the loser back to me to deal with. You bury your own mistakes.
That sounds pretty heartless.
I'm not going to weep over the grave of either boy. I tried to save both their lives. You apparently seem determined to let them find out which is fittest in the best Darwinian fashion.
Calm down, Sister Carlotta. We'll consider what you've told us. We won't be foolish.
You've already been foolish. I have no high expectations for you now.
As days became weeks, the shape of Wigan's army began to unfold, and Bean was filled with both hope and despair. Hope because Wigan was setting up an army that was almost infinitely adaptable. Despair because he was doing it without any reliance on Bean. After only a few practices, Wigan had chosen his toon leaders. Every one of them a veteran from the transfer lists. In fact, every veteran was either a toon leader or a second. Not only that, instead of the normal organization, four tunes of 10 soldiers each, he had created 5 tunes of 8, and then made them practice a lot in half tunes of 4 men each, one commanded by the tune leader, the other by the second. No one had ever fragmented an army like that before. And it wasn't just an illusion. Wigan worked hard to make sure the tune leaders and seconds had plenty of leeway. He'd tell them their objective and let the leader decide how to achieve it. Or he'd group 3 tunes together under the operational command of one of the tune leaders to handle one operation, while Wigan himself commanded the smaller remaining force. It was an extraordinary amount of delegation. Some of the soldiers were critical at first. As they were milling around near the entrance to the barracks, the veterans talked about how they'd practiced that day, in 10 groups of 4. "Everybody knows it's loser strategy to divide your army," said Fly Mola, who commanded A-Toon. Bean was a little disgusted that the soldier with the highest rank after Wigan would say something disparaging about his commander's strategy. Sure, Fly was learning too, but there's such a thing as insubordination. "He hasn't divided the army," said Bean. "He's just organized it. And there's no such thing as a rule of strategy that you can't break. The idea is to have your army concentrated at the decisive point, not to keep it huddled together all the time." Fly glared at Bean. "Just 'cause you little guys can hear us doesn't mean you understand what we're talking about. If you don't want to believe me, think what you want. My talking isn't going to make you stupider than you already are." Fly came at him, grabbing him by the arm and dragging him to the edge of his bunk. At once, Nikolai launched himself from the bunk opposite and landed on Fly's back, bumping his head into the front of Bean's bunk. In moments, the other tune leaders had pulled Fly and Nikolai apart. A ludicrous fight, anyway, since Nikolai wasn't that much bigger than Bean. "Forget it, Fly," said Hot Soup, Han Su, leader of D-Tune. "Nikolai thinks he's Bean's big brother." "What's the kid doing mouthing off to a tune leader?" demanded Fly. "You were being insubordinate toward our commander," said Bean. "And you were also completely wrong. By your view, Lee and Jackson were idiots at Chancellorsville."
"He keeps doing it."
"Are you so stupid you can't recognize the truth just because the person telling it to you is short?" All of Bean's frustration at not being one of the officers was spilling out. He knew it, but he didn't feel like controlling it. They needed to hear the truth. And Wigan needed to have the support when he was being taken down behind his back. Nikolai was standing on the lower bunk, so he was as close to Bean as possible, affirming the bond between them.
"Come on, Fly," said Nikolai. "This is Bean, remember?"
And to Bean's surprise, that silenced Fly. Until this moment, Bean had not realized the power that his reputation had. He might be just a regular soldier in Dragon Army, but he was still the finest student of strategy and military history in the school, and apparently everybody, or at least everybody but Wigan, knew it.
"I should have spoken with more respect," said Bean.
"Damn right," said Fly.
"But so should you."
Fly lunged against the grip of the boys holding him.
"Talking about Wigan," said Bean, "you spoke without respect. Everybody knows it's loser strategy to divide your army."
He got Fly's intonation almost exactly right. Several kids laughed. And grudgingly, so did Fly.
"Okay, right," said Fly.
"I was out of line." He turned to Nikolai. "But I'm still an officer."
"Not when you're dragging a little kid off his bunk, you're not," said Nikolai. "You're a bully when you do that."
Fly blinked. Wisely, no one said a thing until Fly had decided how he was going to respond.
"You're right, Nikolai.
To defend your friend against a bully." He looked from Nikolai to Bean and back again.
"Pusha, you guys even look like brothers."
He walked past them, heading for his bunk. The other tune leaders followed him. Crisis over. Nikolai looked at Bean then.
"I was never as squished up and ugly as you," he said.
"And if I'm going to grow up to look like you, I'm going to kill myself now," said Bean.
"Do you have to talk to really big guys like that?"
"I didn't expect you to attack him like a one-man swarm of bees."
I guess I wanted to jump on somebody, said Nikolai.
You? Mr. Nice Guy?
I don't feel so nice lately. He climbed up on the bunk beside Bean so they could talk more softly.
I'm out of my depth here, Bean. I don't belong in this army.
What do you mean?
I wasn't ready to get promoted. I'm just average. Maybe not that good. And even though this army wasn't a bunch of heroes in the standings, these guys are good. Everybody learns faster than me. Everybody gets it, and I'm still standing there thinking about it.
So you work harder.
I am working harder. You just get it right away, everything. You see it all. And it's not that I'm stupid. I always get it too, just a step behind.
Sorry, said Bean.
What are you sorry about?
It's not your fault.
Yes, it is, Nikolai.
Come on. You telling me you wish you weren't part of Ender Wiggin's army?
Nikolai laughed a little.
He's really something, isn't he?
You'll do your part. You're a good soldier. You'll see. When we get into the battles, you'll do as well as anybody.
Probably. They can always freeze me and throw me around. The big lumpy projectile weapon.
You're not so lumpy.
Everybody's lumpy compared to you. I've watched you. You give away half your food. They feed me too much.
I've got to study.
Nikolai jumped across to his bunk. Bean felt bad sometimes about having put Nikolai in this situation. But when they started winning, a lot of kids outside of Dragon Army would be wishing they could trade places with him. In fact, it was kind of surprising Nikolai realized he wasn't as qualified as the others. After all, the differences weren't that pronounced. Probably there were a lot of kids who felt just like Nikolai. But Bean hadn't really reassured him. In fact, he had probably reaffirmed Nikolai's feelings of inferiority.
What a sensitive friend I am.
There was no point in interviewing Valescu again, not after getting such lies from him the first time. All that talk of copies and him the original. There was no mitigation now. He was a murderer, a servant of the father of lies. He would do nothing to help Sister Carlotta. And the need to find out what might be expected of the one child who evaded Valescu's little holocaust was too great to rely again on the word of such a man. Besides, Valescu had made contact with his half-brother or double-cousin. How else could he have obtained a fertilized egg containing his DNA? So Sister Carlotta should be able either to follow Valescu's trail or duplicate his research. She learned quickly that Valescu was the illegitimate child of a Romanian woman in Budapest. A little checking, and the judicious use of her security clearance, got her the name of the father, a Greek-born official in the League who had recently been promoted to service on the hegemon staff. That might have been a roadblock, but Sister Carlotta did not need to speak to the grandfather. She only needed to know who he was in order to find out the names of his three legitimate children. The daughter was eliminated because the shared parent was a male, and in checking the two sons, she decided to go first to visit the married one. They lived on the island of Crete, where Julian ran a software company whose only client was the International Defense League. Obviously, this was not a coincidence, but nepotism was almost honorable compared to some of the outright graft and favor trading that was endemic in the League. In the long run, such corruption was basically harmless, since the international fleet had seized control of its own budget early on and never let the League touch it again. Thus, the Polemarch and the Strategos had far more money at their disposal than the hegemon, which made him, though first in title, weakest in actual power and independence of movement. And just because Julian Delfici owed his career to his father's political connections did not necessarily mean that his company's product was not adequate and that he himself was not an honest man. By the standards of honesty that prevailed in the world of business, anyway. Sister Carlotta found that she did not need her security clearance to get a meeting with Julian and his wife, Elena. She called, and she said she would like to see them on a matter concerning the IF, and they immediately opened their calendar to her. She arrived in Knossos and was immediately driven to their home on a bluff overlooking the Aegean. They looked nervous. Indeed, Elena was almost frantic, wringing a handkerchief. "Please," she said, after accepting their offer of fruit and cheese, "please tell me why you are so upset. There's nothing about my business that should alarm you." The two of them glanced at each other, and Elena became flustered. "Then there's nothing wrong with our boy?" For a moment, Sister Carlotta wondered if they already knew about Bean. But how could they? "Your son?" "Then he's all right." Elena burst into tears of relief, and when her husband knelt beside her, she clung to him and sobbed.
"You see, it was very hard for us to let him go into service," said Julian. "So when a religious person calls to tell us she needs to see us on business pertaining to the IF, we leapt to the conclusion."
"Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know you had a son in the military, or I would have been careful to assure you from the start that..." "But now I fear I am here under false pretenses. The matter I need to speak to you about is personal. So personal, you may be reluctant to answer. Yet it is about a matter that is of some importance to the IF. Truthful answers cannot possibly expose you to any personal risk, I promise." Elena got control of herself. Julian seated himself again, and now they looked at Sister Carlotta almost with cheerfulness.
"Oh, ask whatever you want," said Julian. "We're just happy that..."
"Whatever you want to ask." "We'll answer if we can," said Elena. "You say you have a son. This raises the possibility that... there is reason to wonder if you might not at some point have... was your son conceived under circumstances that would have allowed a clone of his fertilized egg to be made?"
"Oh, yes," said Elena. "That is no secret. A defect in one fallopian tube and an ectopic pregnancy in the other made it impossible for me to conceive in utero. We wanted a child, so they drew out several of my eggs, fertilized them with my husband's sperm, and then cloned the ones we chose. There were four that we cloned, six copies of each, two girls and two boys. So far we have implanted only the one. He was such a special boy, we did not want to dilute our attention. Now that his education is out of our hands, however, we have been thinking of bearing one of the girls. It's time." She reached over and took Julian's hand and smiled. He smiled back. Such a contrast to Valescu. Hard to believe there was any genetic material in common.
"You said six copies of each of the four fertilized eggs," said Sister Carlotta.
"Six, including the original," said Julian. "That way we have the best chance of implanting each of the four and carrying them through a full pregnancy. A total of 24 fertilized eggs."
"And only one of them was implanted?"
"Yes, we were very fortunate. The first one worked perfectly."
"Leaving 23.
"Yes, exactly.
Mr. Delphiki, all 23 of those fertilized eggs remain in storage, waiting for implantation?"
"Of course."
Sister Carlotta thought for a moment. "How recently have you checked?"
"Just last week," said Julian, "as we began talking about having another child. The doctor assured us that nothing has happened to the eggs, and they can be implanted with only a few hours' notice. But did the doctor actually check?
I don't know, said Julian.
Elena was starting to tense up a little.
What have you heard? She asked.
Nothing, said Sister Carlotta. What I am looking for is the source of a particular child's genetic material. I simply need to make sure that your fertilized eggs were not the source.
But of course they were not, except for our son.
Please don't be alarmed. But I would like to know the name of your doctor and the facility where the eggs are stored. And then I would be glad if you would call your doctor and have him go, in person, to the facility and insist upon seeing the eggs himself.
They can't be seen without a microscope, said Julian.
See that they have not been disturbed, said Sister Carlotta. They had both become hyper-alert again, especially since they had no idea what this was all about, nor could they be told. As soon as Julian gave her the name of the doctor and hospital, Sister Carlotta stepped onto the porch and, as she gazed at the sail-specked Aegean, she used her global and got herself put through to the IF headquarters in Athens. It would take several hours, perhaps, for either her call or Julian's to bring in the answer, so she and Julian and Elena made a heroic effort to appear unconcerned. They took her on a walking tour of their neighborhood, which offered views both ancient and modern, and of nature, verdant, desert, and marine. The dry air was refreshing, as long as the breeze from the sea did not lag, and Sister Carlotta enjoyed hearing Julian talk about his company, and Elena talk about her work as a teacher. All thought of their having risen in the world through government corruption faded, as she realized that, however he got his contract, Julian was a serious, dedicated creator of software, while Elena was a fervent teacher who treated her profession as a crusade.
I knew as soon as I started teaching our son how remarkable he was, Elena told her. But it wasn't until his pretests for school placement that we first learned that his gifts were particularly suited for the IF.
Alarm bells went off. Sister Carlotta had assumed that their son was an adult. After all, they were not a young couple.
How old is your son?
8 years old now, said Julian. They sent us a picture. Quite a little man in his uniform. They don't let many letters come through.
Their son was in battle school.
They appeared to be in their 40s, but they might not have started to have a family until late, and then tried in vain for a while, going through a tubal pregnancy before finding out that Elena could no longer conceive. Their son was only a couple of years older than Bean.
Which meant that Graf could compare Bean's genetic code with that of the Delphiki boy and find out if they were from the same cloned egg. There would be a control to compare what Bean was like with Anton's key turned as opposed to the other, whose genes were unaltered. Now that she thought about it, of course any true sibling of Bean's would have exactly the abilities that would bring the attention of the IF. Anton's key made a child into a savant in general. The particular mix of skills that the IF looked for were not affected. Bean would have had those skills no matter what. The alteration merely allowed him to bring a far sharper intelligence to bear on abilities he already had. If Bean was in fact their child. Yet the coincidence of 23 fertilized eggs and the 23 children that Valescu had produced in the clean room, what other conclusion could she reach? And soon the answer came, first to Sister Carlotta, but immediately thereafter to the Delphikis. The IF investigators had gone to the clinic with the doctor, and together they had discovered that the eggs were missing.
It was hard news for the Delphikis to bear, and Sister Carlotta discreetly waited outside while Elena and Julian took some time alone together. But soon they invited her in. "How much can you tell us?" Julian asked. "You came here because you suspected our babies might have been taken. Tell me, were they born?" Sister Carlotta wanted to hide behind the veil of military secrecy, but in truth there was no military secret involved. Valescu's crime was a matter of public record. And yet, weren't they better off not knowing? "Julian, Elena, accidents happen in the laboratory. They might have died anyway. Nothing is certain. Isn't it better just to think of this as a terrible accident? Why add to the burden of the loss you already have?" Elena looked at her fiercely. "You will tell me, Sister Carlotta, if you love the God of Truth." "The eggs were stolen by a criminal who illegally caused them to be brought through gestation. When his crime was about to be discovered, he gave them a painless death by sedative. They did not suffer."
"And this man will be put on trial?"
"He has already been tried and sentenced to life in prison," said Sister Carlotta.
"Already?" asked Julian.
"How long ago were our babies stolen?"
"More than 7 years ago."
"Oh," cried Elena. "Then our babies, when they died..."
"They were infants, not a year old yet."
"But why our babies? Why would he steal them? Was he going to sell them for adoption? Was he..."
"Does it matter? None of his plans came to fruition," said Sister Carlotta. "The nature of Valescu's experiments were a secret."
"What was the murderer's name?" asked Julian.
Seeing her hesitation, he insisted.
"His name is a matter of public record, is it not?"
"In the criminal courts of Rotterdam," said Sister Carlotta. "Valescu." Julian reacted as if slapped, but immediately controlled himself. Elena did not see it. "He knows about his father's mistress," thought Sister Carlotta. "He understands now what part of the motive had to be. The legitimate son's children were kidnapped by the bastard, experimented on, and eventually killed. And the legitimate son didn't find out about it for 7 years. Whatever privations Valescu fancied that his fatherlessness had caused him, he had taken his vengeance. And for Julian, it also meant that his father's lusts had come back to cause this loss, this pain to Julian and his wife. The sins of the fathers are visited upon the children unto the third and fourth generation. But didn't the scripture say, "The third and fourth generation of them that hate me"? Julian and Elena did not hate God, nor did their innocent babies. It makes no more sense than Herod's slaughter of the babes of Bethlehem. The only comfort was the trust that a merciful God caught up the spirits of the slain infants into his bosom, and that he brought comfort, eventually, to the parents' hearts. "Please," said Sister Carlotta, "I cannot say you should not grieve for the children that you will never hold, but you can still rejoice in the child that you have."
"A million miles away," cried Elena.
"I don't suppose... You don't happen to know if the battle school ever lets a child come home for a visit," said Julian. "His name is Nikolai Delphiki. Surely under the circumstances..."
"I'm so sorry," said Sister Carlotta. Reminding them of the child they had was not such a good idea after all, when they did not, in fact, have him. I'm sorry that my coming led to such terrible news for you.
But you learned what you came to learn, said Julian.
Yes, said Sister Carlotta.
Then Julian realized something, though he said not a word in front of his wife.
Will you want to return to the airport now?
Yes, the car is still waiting. Soldiers are much more patient than cab drivers.
I'll walk you to the car, said Julian.
No, Julian, said Elena. Don't leave me.
Just for a few moments, my love. Even now we don't forget courtesy.
He held his wife for a long moment, then led Sister Carlotta to the door and opened it for her. As they walked to the car, Julian spoke of what he had come to understand.
Since my father's bastard is already in prison, you did not come here because of his crime.
No, she said.
One of our children is still alive, he said.
What I tell you now I should not tell, because it is not within my authority, said Sister Carlotta. But my first allegiance is to God, not the IF. If the 22 children who died at Valescu's hand were yours, then a 23rd may be alive. It remains for genetic testing to be done.
But we will not be told, said Julian.
Not yet, said Sister Carlotta. And not soon. Perhaps not ever. But if it is within my power, then a day will come when you will meet your second son.
Is he... Do you know him?
If it is your son, she said, then yes, I know him. His life has been hard, but his heart is good, and he is such a boy as to make any father or mother proud. Please don't ask me more. I've already said too much.
Do I tell this to my wife? Asked Julian. What will be harder for her, to know or not know?
Women are not so different from men. You preferred to know.
Julian nodded. I know that you were only the bearer of news, not the cause of our loss. But your visit here will not be remembered with happiness. Yet I want you to know that I understand how kindly you have done this miserable job.
She nodded. And you have been unfailingly gracious in a difficult hour. Julian opened the door of her car. She stooped to the seat, swung her legs inside. But before he could close the door for her, she thought of one last question, a very important one. Julian, I know you were planning to have a daughter next. But if you had gone on to bring another son into the world, what would you have named him?
Our firstborn was named for my father, Nikolai, he said. But Elena wanted to name a second son for me.
Julian Delfiki, said Sister Carlotta. If this truly is your son, I think he would be proud some day to bear his father's name.
What name does he use now? Asked Julian.
Of course I cannot say.
But not Valescu, surely.
No. As far as I'm concerned, he'll never hear that name. God bless you, Julian Delfiki. I will pray for you and your wife.
Pray for our children's souls, too, sister.
I already have, and do, and will.
Major Anderson looked at the boy sitting across the table from him. Really, it's not that important a matter, Nikolai. I thought maybe I was in trouble. No, no. We just noticed that you seemed to be a particular friend of Bean. He doesn't have a lot of friends. It didn't help that Dymac painted a target on him in the shuttle, and now Ender's gone and done the same thing. I suppose Bean can take it, but smart as he is, he kind of pisses off a lot of the other kids. But not you. Oh, he pisses me off, too. And yet you became his friend. Well, I didn't mean to.
I just had the bunk across from him in Launchy Barracks.
You traded for that bunk.
Did I? Oh. Huh.
And you did that before you knew how smart Bean was.
Dymac told us in the shuttle that Bean had the highest scores of any of us.
Was that why you wanted to be near him? Nikolai shrugged. It was an act of kindness, said Major Anderson. Perhaps I'm just an old cynic, but when I see such an explicable act, I become curious.
He really does kind of look like my baby pictures. Isn't that dumb? I saw him and I thought he looks just like cute little baby Nikolai, which is what my mother always called me in my baby pictures. I never thought of them as me. I was big Nikolai. That was cute little baby Nikolai. I used to pretend that he was my little brother, and we just happened to have the same name. Big Nikolai and cute little baby Nikolai.
I see that you're ashamed, but you shouldn't be. It's a natural thing for an only child to do.
I wanted a brother.
Many who have a brother wish they didn't.
But the brother I made up for myself, he and I got along fine.
Nikolai laughed at the absurdity of it. And you saw Bean and thought of him as the brother you once imagined?
At first. Now I know who he really is, and it's better. It's like, sometimes he's the little brother and I'm looking out for him, and sometimes he's the big brother and he's looking out for me.
For instance?
What?
A boy that small, how does he look out for you?
He gives me advice. Helps me with classwork. We do some practice together. He's better at almost everything than I am, only I'm bigger, and I think I like him more than he likes me.
That may be true, Nikolai. But as far as we can tell, he likes you more than he likes anybody else. He just, well, so far, he may not have the same capacity for friendship that you have. I hope that my asking you these questions won't change your feelings and actions toward Bean. We don't assign people to be friends, but I hope you'll remain Bean's.
I'm not his friend, said Nikolai.
Oh?
I told you. I'm his brother.
Nikolai grinned.
Once you get a brother, you don't give him up easy.
Chapter 15. Courage.
Genetically, they're identical twins. The only difference is Anton's key.
So the Delphiki have two sons?
The Delphiki have one son, Nikolai, and he's with us for the duration. Bean was an orphan found on the streets of Rotterdam.
Because he was kidnapped.
The law is clear. Fertilized eggs are property. I know that this is a matter of religious sensitivity for you, but the IF is bound by law, not...
The IF uses law where possible to achieve its own ends. I know you're fighting a war. I know that some things are outside your power, but the war will not go on forever. All I ask is this. Make this information part of a record, part of many records, so that when the war ends, the proof of these things can and will survive, so the truth won't stay hidden.
Of course.
No, not of course. You know that the moment the Formics are defeated, the IF will have no reason to exist. It will try to continue to exist in order to maintain international peace. But the League is not politically strong enough to survive in the nationalist winds that will blow. The IF will break into fragments, each following its own leader. And God help us if any part of the fleet ever should use its weapons against the surface of the Earth.
You've been spending too much time reading the Apocalypse.
I may not be one of the genius children in your school, but I see how the tides of opinion are flowing here on Earth. On the nets, a demagogue named Demosthenes is inflaming the West about illegal and secret maneuvers by the Polemarch to give an advantage to the new Warsaw Pact. And the propaganda is even more virulent from Moscow, Baghdad, Buenos Aires, Beijing. There are a few rational voices, like Locke, but they're given lip service and then ignored. You and I can't do anything about the fact that world war will certainly come. But we can do our best to make sure these children don't become pawns in that game.
The only way they won't be pawns is if they're players.
You've been raising them. Surely you don't fear them. Give them their chance to play.
Sister Carlotta, all my work is aimed at preparing for the showdown with the Formics, at turning these children into brilliant, reliable commanders. I can't look beyond that mark.
Don't look. Just leave the door open for their families, their nations to claim them.
I can't think about that right now.
Right now is the only time you'll have the power to do it.
You overestimate me.
You underestimate yourself.
Dragon Army had only been practicing for a month when Wigan came into the barracks only a few seconds after lights on, brandishing a slip of paper. Battle orders. They would face Rabbit Army at 0700, and they'd do it without breakfast. I don't want anybody throwing up in the battle room. Can we at least take a leak first? Asked Nikolai. No more than a deciliter, said Wigan. Everybody laughed, but they were also nervous. As a new army with only a handful of veterans, they didn't actually expect to win, but they didn't want to be humiliated either. They all had different ways of dealing with nerves. Some became silent, others talkative. Some joked and bantered, others turned surly. Some just lay back down on their bunks and closed their eyes. Bean watched them. He tried to remember if the kids in Poke's crew ever did these things, and then realized they were hungry, not afraid of being shamed. You don't get this kind of fear until you have enough to eat. So it was the bullies who felt like these kids, afraid of humiliation but not of going hungry. And sure enough, the bullies standing around in line showed all these attitudes. They were always performing, always aware of others watching them. Fearful they would have to fight. Eager for it, too. What do I feel? What's wrong with me that I have to think about it to know? Oh. I'm just sitting here watching. I'm one of those. Bean pulled out his flash suit, but then realized he had to use the toilet before putting it on. He dropped down onto the deck and pulled his towel from its hook, wrapped it around himself. For a moment, he flashed back to that night he had tossed his towel under a bunk and climbed into the ventilation system. He'd never fit now. Too thickly muscled, too tall. He was still the shortest kid in battle school, and he doubted if anyone else would notice how he'd grown. But he was aware of how his arms and legs were longer. He could reach things more easily. Didn't have to jump so often just to do normal things like palming his way into the gym. I've changed, thought Bean. My body, of course. But also the way I think. Nikolai was still lying in bed with his pillow over his head. Everybody had his own way of coping. The other kids were all using the toilets and getting drinks of water, but Bean was the only one who thought it was a good idea to shower. They used to tease him by asking if the water was still warm when it got all the way down there, but the joke was old now. What Bean wanted was the steam. The blindness of the fog around him, of the fogged mirrors, everything hidden so he could be anyone, anywhere, any size. Someday they'll all see me as I see myself. Larger than any of them. Head and shoulders above the rest, seeing farther, reaching farther, carrying burdens they could only dream of. In Rotterdam, all I cared about was staying alive. But here, well fed, I've found out who I am, what I might be. They might think I'm an alien or a robot or something, just because I'm not genetically ordinary. But when I've done the great deeds of my life, they'll be proud to claim me as a human. Furious at anyone who questions whether I'm truly one of them. Greater than Wigan. He put the thought out of his mind, or tried to. This wasn't a competition. There was room for two great men in the world at the same time. Lee and Grant were contemporaries, fought against each other. Bismarck and Disraeli. Napoleon and Wellington. No, that's not the comparison. It's Lincoln and Grant. Two great men working together. It was disconcerting, though, to realize how rare that was. Napoleon could never bear to let any of his lieutenants have real authority. All victories had to be his alone. Who was the great man beside Augustus? Alexander. They had friends, they had rivals, but they never had partners. That's why Wigan has kept me down, even though he knows by now from the reports they give to army commanders that I've got a mind better than anybody else in Dragon. Because I'm too obviously a rival. Because I made it clear that first day that I intended to rise, and he's letting me know that it won't happen while I'm with his army. Someone came into the bathroom. Bean couldn't see who it was because of the fog. Nobody greeted him. Everybody else must have finished here and gone back to get ready. The newcomer walked through the fog past the opening in Bean's shower stall. It was Wigan. Bean just stood there, covered with soap. He felt like an idiot. He was in such a daze he had forgotten to rinse, was just standing in the fog, lost in his thoughts. Hurriedly, he moved under the water again. Bean? Sir? Bean turned to face him. Wigan was standing in the shower entrance. I thought I ordered everybody to get down to the gym. Bean thought back. The scene unfolded in his mind. Yes, Wigan had ordered everybody to bring their flash suits to the gym. I'm sorry. I was thinking of something else. Everybody's nervous before their first battle. Bean hated that. To have Wigan see him doing something stupid. Not remembering an order. Bean remembered everything. It just hadn't registered. And now he was patronizing him. Everybody's nervous. You weren't, said Bean. Wigan had already stepped away. He came back. Wasn't I? Bonzo Madrid gave you orders not to take your weapon out. You were supposed to just stay there like a dummy. You weren't nervous about doing that. No, said Wigan. I was pissed. Better than nervous. Wigan started to leave, then returned again. Are you pissed? I did that before I showered, said Bean. Wigan laughed. Then his smile disappeared. You're late, Bean, and you're still busy rinsing. I've already got your flash suit down in the gym. All we need now is your ass in it. Wigan took Bean's towel off its hook. I'll have this waiting for you down there, too. Now move. Wigan left. Bean turned the water off, furious. That was completely unnecessary, and Wigan knew it. Making him go through the corridor wet and naked during the time when other armies would be coming back from breakfast? That was low, and it was stupid. Anything to put me down. Every chance he gets. Bean, you idiot, you're still standing here. You could have run down to the gym and beaten him there. Instead, you're shooting your stupid self in the stupid foot. And why? None of this makes sense. None of this is going to help you. You want him to make you a toon leader, not think of you with contempt. So why are you doing things to make yourself look stupid and young and scared and unreliable? And still you're standing here, frozen. I'm a coward. The thought ran through Bean's mind and filled him with terror. But it wouldn't go away. I'm one of those guys who freezes up or does completely irrational things when he's afraid, who loses control and goes slack-minded and stupid. But I didn't do that in Rotterdam. If I had, I'd be dead. Or maybe I did do it. Maybe that's why I didn't call out to Polk and Achille when I saw them there alone on the dock. He wouldn't have killed her if I'd been there to witness what happened. Instead, I ran off until I realized the danger she was in. But why didn't I realize it before? Because I did realize it, just as I heard Wigan tell us to meet in the gym. Realized it, understood it completely, but was too cowardly to act, too afraid that something would go wrong. And maybe that's what happened when Achille lay on the ground and I told Polk to kill him. I was wrong and she was right.
because any bully she caught that way would probably have held a grudge, and might easily have acted on it immediately, killing her as soon as they let him up. Ashiel was the likeliest one, maybe the only one that would agree to the arrangement Bean had thought up. There was no choice. But I got scared. Kill him, I said, because I wanted it to go away. And still I'm standing here. The water is off. I'm dripping wet and cold. But I can't move. Nikolai was standing in the bathroom doorway. Too bad about your diarrhea, he said. What? I told Ender about how you were up with diarrhea in the night. That's why you had to go to the bathroom. You were sick, but you didn't want to tell him because you didn't want to miss the first battle. I'm so scared I couldn't take a dump if I wanted to, said Bean. He gave me your towel. He said it was stupid of him to take it. Nikolai walked in and gave it to him. He said he needs you in the battle, so he's glad you're toughing it out. He doesn't need me. He doesn't even want me. Come on, Bean, said Nikolai. You can do this. Bean toweled off. It felt good to be moving, doing something. I think you're dry enough, said Nikolai. Again, Bean realized he was simply drying and drying himself over and over. Nikolai, what's wrong with me? You're afraid that you'll turn out to be just a little kid. Well, here's a clue. You are a little kid. So are you. So it's okay to be really bad. Isn't that what you keep telling me? Nikolai laughed. Come on. If I can do it, bad as I am, so can you. Nikolai, said Bean. What now? I really do have to crap. I sure hope you don't expect me to wipe your butt. If I don't come out in 3 minutes, come in after me. Cold and sweating, a combination he wouldn't have thought possible, Bean went into the toilet stall and closed the door. The pain in his abdomen was fierce, but he couldn't get his bowel to loosen up and let go. What am I so afraid of? Finally, his alimentary system triumphed over his nervous system. It felt like everything he'd ever eaten flooded out of him at once. Time's up, said Nikolai. I'm coming in. At peril of your life, said Bean. I'm done, I'm coming out. Empty now, clean, and humiliated in front of his only real friend, Bean came out of the stall and wrapped his towel around him. Thanks for keeping me from being a liar, said Nikolai. What? About your having diarrhea. For you, I'd get dysentery. Now that's friendship. By the time they got to the gym, everybody was already in their flash suits, ready to go. While Nikolai helped Bean get into his suit, Wigan had the rest of them lie down on the mats and do relaxation exercises. Bean even had time to lie down for a couple of minutes before Wigan had them get up. 06:56. 4 minutes to get to the battle room. He was cutting it pretty fine. As they ran along the corridor, Wigan occasionally jumped up to touch the ceiling. Behind him, the rest of the army would jump up and touch the same spot when they reached it. Except the smaller ones. Bean, his heart still burning with humiliation and resentment and fear, did not try. You do that kind of thing when you belong with the group. And he didn't belong. After all his brilliance in class, the truth was out now. He was a coward. He didn't belong in the military at all. If he couldn't even risk playing a game, what would he be worth in combat? The real generals exposed themselves to enemy fire. Fearless, they had to be, an example of courage to their men. Me? I freeze up, take long showers, and dump a week's rations into the head. Let's see them follow that example. At the gate, Wigan had time to line them up in tunes, then remind them. Which way is the enemy's gate? Down, they all answered. Bean only mouthed the word. Down. Down, down, down. What's the best way to get down off a goose? What are you doing up on a goose in the first place, you fool? The gray wall in front of them disappeared, and they could see into the battle room. It was dim,
not dark, but so faintly lighted that the only way they could see the enemy gate was the light of Rabbit Army's flash suits pouring out of it. Wigan was in no hurry to get out of the gate. He stood there surveying the room, which was arranged in an open grid with 8 stars, large cubes that served as obstacles, cover, and staging platforms, distributed fairly evenly, if randomly, through the space. Wigan's first assignment was to C-Tune, Crazy Tom's tune, the tune Bean belonged to. Word was whispered down the file. Ender says slide the wall. And then, Tom says flash your legs and go in on your knees. South wall. Silently they swung into the room, using the handholds to propel themselves along the ceiling to the east wall. They're setting up their battle formation. All we want to do is cut them up a little, make them nervous, confused, because they don't know what to do with us. We're raiders. So we shoot them up, then get behind that star. Don't get stuck out in the middle. And aim. Make every shot count. Bean did everything mechanically. It was habit now to get in position, freeze his own legs, and then launch with his body oriented the right way. They'd done it hundreds of times. He did it exactly right. So did the other 7 soldiers in the tomb. Nobody was looking for anyone to fail. He was right where they expected him to be, doing his job. They coasted along the wall, always within reach of a handhold. Their frozen legs were dark, blocking the lights of the rest of their flash suits until they were fairly close. Wigan was doing something up near the gate to distract Rabbit Army's attention, so the surprise was pretty good. As they got closer, Crazy Tom said, split and rebound to the star. Me north, you south. It was a maneuver that Crazy Tom had practiced with his tune. It was the right time for it, too. It would confuse the enemy more to have 2 groups to shoot at, heading different directions. They pulled up on handholds. Their bodies, of course, swung against the wall, and suddenly the lights of their flash suits were quite visible. Somebody in Rabbit saw them and gave the alarm. But C was already moving, half the tune diagonally south, the other half north, and all angling downward toward the floor. Bean began firing. The enemy was also firing at him. He heard the low whine that said somebody's beam was on his suit, but he was twisting slowly and far enough from the enemy that none of the beams was in one place long enough to do damage. In the meantime, he found that his arm tracked perfectly, not trembling at all. He had practiced this a lot, and he was good at it. A clean kill, not just an arm or leg. He had time for a second before he hit the wall and had to rebound up to the rendezvous star. One more enemy hit before he got there, and then he snagged a handhold on the star and said, Bean here. Lost 3, said Crazy Tom. But their formation's all gone to hell. What now? Said Dag. They could tell from the shouting that the main battle was in progress. Bean was thinking back over what he had seen as he approached the star. They sent 12 guys to this star to wipe us out, said Bean. They'll come around the east and west sides. They all looked at him like he was insane. How could he know this? We've got about 1 more second, said Bean. All south, said Crazy Tom. They swung up to the south side of the star. There were no rabbits on that face, but Crazy Tom immediately led them in an attack around to the west face. Sure enough, there were rabbits there, caught in the act of attacking what they clearly thought of as the back of the star, or as Dragon Army was trained to think of it, the bottom. So to the rabbits, the attack seemed to come from below, the direction they were least aware of. In moments, the 6 rabbits on that face were frozen and drifting along below the star. The other half of the attack force would see that and know what had happened. Top, said Crazy Tom. To the enemy, that would be the front of the star, the position most exposed to fire from the main formation. The last place they'd expect Tom's tune to go. And once they were there, instead of continuing to attempt to engage the strike force coming against them, Crazy Tom had them shoot at the main rabbit formation, or what was left of it. Mostly disorganized groups hiding behind stars and firing at dragons coming down at them from several directions. The 5 of them in C-Tune had time to hit a couple of rabbits each before the strike force found them again. Without waiting for orders, Bean immediately launched away from the surface of the star so he could shoot downward at the strike force. This close, he was able to do 4 quick kills before the whining abruptly stopped and his suit went completely stiff and dark. The rabbit who got him wasn't one of the strike force. It was somebody from the main force above him. And to his satisfaction, Bean could see that because of his firing, only one soldier from C-Toon was hit by the strike force sent against them. Then he rotated out of view. It didn't matter now. He was out. But he had done well. 7 kills that he was sure of, maybe more. And it was more than his personal score. He had come up with the information Crazy Tom needed in order to make a good tactical decision, and then he had taken the bold action that kept the strike force from causing too many casualties. As a result, C-Toon remained in position to strike at the enemy from behind. Without any place to hide, Rabbit would be wiped out in moments. And Bean was part of it. I didn't freeze once we got into action. I did what I was trained to do, and I stayed alert, and I thought of things. I can probably do better, move faster, see more. But for a first battle, I did fine. I can do this. Because C-Toon was crucial to the victory, Wigan used the other 4 Toon leaders to press their helmets to the corners of the enemy gate and gave Crazy Tom the honor of passing through the gate, which is what formally ended the game, bringing the lights on bright. Major Anderson himself came in to congratulate the winning commander and supervise cleanup. Wigan quickly unfroze the casualties. Bean was relieved when his suit could move again. Using his hook, Wigan drew them all together and formed his soldiers into their 5 Toons before he began unfreezing Rabbit Army. They stood at attention in the air, their feet pointed down, their heads up. And as Rabbit unfroze, they gradually oriented themselves in the same direction. They had no way of knowing it, but to Dragon, that was when victory became complete. For the enemy was now oriented as if their own gate was down. Bean and Nikolai were already eating breakfast when Crazy Tom came to their table. Ender says instead of 15 minutes for breakfast, we have until 07:45. And he'll let us out of practice in time to shower. That was good news. They could slow down their eating. Not that it mattered to Bean. His tray had little food on it, and he finished it immediately. Once he was in Dragon Army, Crazy Tom had caught him giving away food. Bean told him that he was always given too much, and Tom took the matter to Ender, and Ender got the nutritionists to stop overfeeding Bean. Today was the first time Bean ever wished for more, and that was only because he was so up from the battle. "Smart," said Nikolai. "What?" "Ender tells us we've got 15 minutes to eat, which feels rushed, and we don't like it. Then right away he sends around the Toon leaders, telling us we have till 07:45. That's only 10 minutes longer, but now it feels like forever. And a shower. We're supposed to be able to shower right after the game, but now we're grateful." "And he gave the Toon leaders the chance to bring good news," said Bean. "Is that important?" asked Nikolai. "We know it was Ender's choice." "Most commanders make sure all good news comes from them," said Bean, "and bad news from the Toon leaders. But Wigan's whole technique is building up his Toon leaders. Crazy Tom went in there with nothing more than his training and his brains and a single objective. Strike first from the wall and get behind them. All the rest was up to him."
"Yeah, but if his Toon leaders screw up, it looks bad on Ender's record," said Nikolai.
Bean shook his head.
"The point is that in his very first battle, Wigan divided his force for tactical effect, and C-Toon was able to continue attacking even after we ran out of plans, because Crazy Tom was really, truly in charge of us. We didn't sit around wondering what Wigan wanted us to do."
Nikolai got it and nodded.
"Bacana. That's right."
"Completely right," said Bean. By now everybody at the table was listening. "And that's because Wigan isn't just thinking about battle school and standings and Merida like that. He keeps watching vids of the second invasion. Did you know that? He's thinking about how to beat the buggers. And he knows that the way you do that is to have as many commanders ready to fight them as you can get. Wigan doesn't want to come out of this with Wigan as the only commander ready to fight the buggers. He wants to come out of this with him and the Toon Leaders and the Seconds, and if he can do it, every single one of his soldiers ready to command a fleet against the buggers if we have to. Bean knew his enthusiasm was probably giving Wigan credit for more than he had actually planned, but he was still full of the glow of victory. And besides, what he was saying was true. Wigan was no Napoleon, holding on to the reins of control so tightly that none of his commanders was capable of brilliant independent command. Crazy Tom had performed well under pressure. He had made the right decisions, including the decision to listen to his smallest, most useless-looking soldier. And Crazy Tom had done that because Wigan had set the example by listening to his Toon Leaders. You learn, you analyze, you choose, you act. After breakfast, as they headed for practice, Nikolai asked him, "Why do you call him Wigan?" "'Cause we're not friends," said Bean. "Oh, so it's Mr. Wigan and Mr. Bean, is that it?" "No, Bean is my first name." "Oh, so it's Mr. Wigan and who the hell are you?" "Got it." Everybody expected to have at least a week to strut around and brag about their perfect one-loss record. Instead, the next morning at 06:30, Wigan appeared in the barracks, again brandishing battle orders. "Gentlemen, I hope you learned something yesterday, because today we're going to do it again." All were surprised, and some were angry. It wasn't fair. They weren't ready. Wigan just handed the orders to Fly Molo, who had just been heading out for breakfast. "Flash suits!" cried Fly, who clearly thought it was a cool thing to be the first army ever to fight two in a row like this. But Hot Soup, the leader of D-Toon, had another attitude. "Why didn't you tell us earlier?" "I thought you needed the shower," said Wigan. "Yesterday, Rabbit Army claimed we only won because the stink knocked them out." Everybody within earshot laughed. But Bean was not amused. He knew that the paper hadn't been there first thing when Wigan woke up. The teachers planted it late. "Didn't find the paper till you got back from the showers, right?" Wigan gave him a blank look. "Of course. I'm not as close to the floor as you." The contempt in his voice struck Bean like a blow. Only then did he realize that Wigan had taken his question as a criticism, that Wigan had been inattentive and hadn't noticed the orders. So now there was one more mark against Bean in Wigan's mental dossier. The Bean couldn't let that upset him. It's not as if Wigan didn't have him tagged as a coward. Maybe Crazy Tom told Wigan about how Bean contributed to the victory yesterday, and maybe not. It wouldn't change what Wigan had seen with his own eyes. Bean malingering in the shower. And now Bean apparently taunting him for making them all have to rush for their second battle. "Maybe I'll be made Toon Leader on my 30th birthday, and then only if everybody else is drowned in a boat accident." Wigan was still talking, of course, explaining how they should expect battles any time. The old rules were coming apart. "I can't pretend I like the way they're screwing around with us, but I do like one thing, that I've got an army that can handle it." As he put on his flash suit, Bean thought through the implications of what the teachers were doing. They were pushing Wigan faster and also making it harder for him. And this was only the beginning. Just the first few sprinkles of a snot storm. Why? Not because Wigan was so good he needed the testing. On the contrary, Wigan was training his army well, and the battle school would only benefit from giving him plenty of time to do it. So it had to be something outside battle school. Only one possibility, really. The bugger invaders were getting close, only a few years away. They had to get Wigan through training. Wigan. Not all of us. Just Wigan. because if it were everybody, then everybody's schedule would be stepped up like this, not just ours. So it's already too late for me. Wigan's the one they've chosen to rest their hopes on. Whether I'm Toon leader or not will never matter. All that matters is, will Wigan be ready? If Wigan succeeds, there'll still be room for me to achieve greatness in the aftermath. The League will come apart. There'll be war among humans. Either I'll be used by the IF to help keep the peace, or maybe I can get into some army on Earth. I've got plenty of life ahead of me. Unless Wigan commands our fleet against the invading buggers and loses, then none of us has any life at all. All I can do right now is my best to help Wigan learn everything he can learn here. The trouble is, I'm not close enough to him for me to have any effect on him at all. The battle was with Petra Arcanian, commander of Phoenix Army. Petra was sharper than Karn Carby had been. She also had the advantage of hearing how Wigan worked entirely without formations and used little raiding parties to disrupt formations ahead of the main combat. Still, Dragon finished with only 3 soldiers flashed and 9 partially disabled. A crushing defeat. Bean could see that Petra didn't like it either. She probably felt like Wigan had poured it on, deliberately setting her up for humiliation. But she'd get it soon enough. Wigan simply turned his Toon leaders loose, and each of them pursued total victory as he had trained them. Their system worked better, that's all, and the old way of doing battle was doomed. Soon enough, all the other commanders would start adapting, learning from what Wigan did. Soon enough, Dragon Army would be facing armies that were divided into 5 Toons, not 4, and that moved in a free-ranging style with a lot more discretion given to the Toon leaders. The kids didn't get to battle school because they were idiots. The only reason the techniques worked a second time was because there'd only been a day since the first battle, and nobody expected to have to face Wigan again so soon. Now they'd know that changes would have to be made fast. Bean guessed that they'd probably never see another formation. What then? Had Wigan emptied his magazine, or would he have new tricks up his sleeve? The trouble was, innovation never resulted in victory over the long term. It was too easy for the enemy to imitate and improve on your innovations. The real test for Wigan would be what he did when he was faced with slugfests between armies using similar tactics. And the real test for me will be seeing if I can stand it when Wigan makes some stupid mistake and I have to sit here as an ordinary soldier and watch him do it. The third day, another battle. The fourth day, another. Victory, victory. But each time, the score was closer. Each time, Bean gained more confidence as a soldier, and became more frustrated that the most he could contribute, beyond his own good aim, was occasionally making a suggestion to Crazy Tom, or reminding him of something Bean had noticed and remembered. Bean wrote to Dymac about it, explaining how he was being underused and suggesting that he would be getting better trained by working with a worse commander, where he'd have a better chance of getting his own tune. The answer was short. Who else would want you? Learn from Ender. Brutal, but true. No doubt even Wigan didn't really want him. Either he was forbidden to transfer any of his soldiers, or he had tried to trade Bean away and no one would take him.